This is the University of Cambridge Local Examinations Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, November 1998 examination, in English as a second language. Paper 4, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, candidate number, and center number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. The tape should now be stopped and the papers handed out. Now you are all ready. Here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. You will hear each question twice. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each question twice. Question 1. Mrs. Backer, your chemistry teacher, wants you to get a book from the library. What is the book's reference number?
We need that new chemistry book from the library. It's called Chemistry Made Simple by Ian Thomas, and the reference number is CHOL32197. We need that new chemistry book from the library. It's called Chemistry Made Simple by Ian Thomas, and the reference number is CHOL32197.
Question 2. Norma is criticizing the film she saw last night. What does she think was wrong with it?
Everyone's been talking about this new film, A World Away, so my sister and I went into town last night to see it. I suppose it wasn't too bad, but the ending, when the hero simply gave up, was pathetic. Everyone's been talking about this new film, A World Away, so my sister and I went into town last night to see it. I suppose it wasn't too bad, but the ending, when the hero simply gave up, was pathetic.
Question 3. Sally is talking to her friend about her family's recent move to a new house. Why did they have to leave the old house?
Well, the old house was okay, really. A bit on the small side, maybe. But the real reason we moved was the neighbours, who made such a terrible noise all the time. Our new neighbours are great, and we've got a lovely big garden. Well, the old house was okay, really. A bit on the small side, maybe. But the real reason we moved was the neighbours, who made such a terrible noise all the time. Our new neighbours are great, and we've got a lovely big garden.
Question 4. Your father has just returned from work. Why is he so angry?
I just don't believe it. They want me to work until 10 o'clock next Saturday night. There are no buses at that time of the day. So I suppose your mother will have to come and pick me up in the car. I just don't believe it. They want me to work until 10 o'clock next Saturday night. There are no buses at that time of the day. So I suppose your mother will have to come and pick me up in the car.
Question 5. Athan's car has just broken down, so she asks a passerby for directions to the nearest garage. Where exactly is it?
The nearest garage? It's quite a walk, but you'll find it at the bottom of the hill, straight across from the bank. There used to be one just round the corner by the school, but it burnt down last summer. The nearest garage? It's quite a walk, but you'll find it at the bottom of the hill, straight across from the bank. There used to be one just round the corner by the school, but it burnt down last summer.
Question 6. Your mother has asked you to go shopping. What exactly does she want?
Can you nip down to the supermarket and get me another vegetable knife? One of those ones with a wooden handle, not one of those plastic ones. If we've got 2 knives, your father won't have any excuses for not helping me in the kitchen. Can you nip down to the supermarket and get me another vegetable knife? One of those ones with a wooden handle, not one of those plastic ones. If we've got 2 knives, your father won't have any excuses for not helping me in the kitchen.
That is the last question in part 1. In a moment, you will hear part 2. Now look at part 2, exercise 1. Part 2. Exercise 1. Question 7. Listen to this talk given about the famous opera house in Sydney and complete the notes. You will hear the talk twice.
G'day. Can I begin by thanking you all for coming today? We've got a real fight on our hands, but I'd like to explain to you all how things have got to the very sorry state they're in at the moment. I'm Tom Anderson and chairman of the Action Group, but many of you may know me better as a trade union leader. I'm still interested in those issues, but now I'm very active in anything that will help keep Sydney as green and as environmentally friendly as possible. In the past, this great city of ours has been the target for invasion. But now, the most famous Sydney landmark, the Opera House, is being threatened by commercial interests that see money as being more important than the splendid views we've always had of one of the real wonders of the New World. The proposed hotel developments, only a few hundred yards from the Opera House, will mean that for thousands of the inhabitants of the city, it just won't be possible any longer for them to have a view of this famous landmark. Hotels, of course, are fine, but it's a sad day for this city that it has completely sold its soul for the money that the tourists will bring in through this huge new hotel. The Opera House was put up in 1973. It stood in almost splendid isolation, except for the fact that it has been flanked by the Royal Gardens and by the city's splendid harbour. Things were okay for a few years, but when the value of land began to fall in 1992-93, the group which owned the ground around the Opera House wanted to recoup its losses by building a series of developments which would have completely towered over it. I'm not at all sorry to say that these proposals were howled down by public protests and dismissed as quite inappropriate by the local state government and by national government. There was a lot of manoeuvring, however, to find the solution to this problem, and in the end it was agreed, don't ask me how, to build a hotel which was lower than the original proposed building, but was much wider. And as we all know, work on this new scheme has already begun. And one of our most respected architects has coined the famous phrase that the hotel is like a big ugly tooth. What I'd like to get across to you today is, like the others in the Action Group, I'm campaigning to persuade the state government to purchase the land back from the developers and to create the kind of park which we all feel would enhance the appearance of Australia's most famous landmark. That's really all we have to say. But if any of you have any questions...
Now you will hear the talk again.
G'day. Can I begin by thanking you all for coming today? We've got a real fight on our hands, but I'd like to explain to you all how things have got to the very sorry state they're in at the moment. I'm Tom Anderson and chairman of the Action Group, but many of you may know me better as a trade union leader. I'm still interested in those issues, but now I'm very active in anything that will help keep Sydney as green and as environmentally friendly as possible. In the past, this great city of ours has been the target for invasion. But now, the most famous Sydney landmark, the Opera House, is being threatened by commercial interests that see money as being more important than the splendid views we've always had of one of the real wonders of the New World. The proposed hotel developments, only a few hundred yards from the Opera House, will mean that for thousands of the inhabitants of the city, it just won't be possible any longer for them to have a view of this famous landmark. Hotels, of course, are fine, but it's a sad day for this city that it has completely sold its soul for the money that the tourists will bring in through this huge new hotel. The Opera House was put up in 1973 and has stood in almost splendid isolation, except for the fact that it's been flanked by the Royal Gardens and by the city's splendid harbour. Things were okay for a few years, but when the value of land began to fall in 1992-93, the group which owned the ground around the Opera House wanted to recoup its losses by building a series of developments which would have completely towered over it. I'm not at all sorry to say that these proposals were howled down by public protests and dismissed as quite inappropriate by the local state government and by national government. There was a lot of manoeuvring, however, to find a solution to this problem, and in the end it was agreed, don't ask me how, to build a hotel which was lower than the original proposed building, but was much wider. And as we all know, work on this new scheme has already begun. And one of our most respected architects has coined the famous phrase that the hotel is like a big ugly tooth. What I'd like to get across to you today is, like the others in the Action Group, I'm campaigning to persuade the state government to purchase the land back from the developers and to create the kind of park which we all feel would enhance the appearance of Australia's most famous landmark. That's really all we have to say. But if any of you have any questions...
That is the end of exercise one. In a moment, you will hear exercise two. Now look at the questions for exercise two. Part 2. Exercise 2. Questions 8 to 12. Listen to this interview with a doctor who is concerned about the use of slimming pills and complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Welcome to this week's Medical Express program. Tonight we have the usual wide-ranging series of medical and related topics, and we start with an interview with Dr. John Collins, someone who has been watching the situation regarding slimming pills very carefully. Dr. Collins, a lot of our viewers will not have heard of the idea of pills for slimming. Can you give us a bit of background, first of all?
Of course. Basically, we're talking about a whole range of diet pills that tempt people to lose weight the easy way. Huge numbers of backstreet clinics are making a killing on this. And while the medical profession may have no real objection to that, we're very worried that not enough is understood about the side effects of these pills, and that those who really need them, the truly overweight or obese, are simply missing out. As you might expect, the usual reasons that patients give for wanting to lose weight through using slimming pills are twofold. They want to look better for holidays or special occasions, and they also realize that they'll probably feel better as well if they shed a few kilos.
Well, all of that sounds quite predictable and understandable, but where are the grounds for concern?
It's hard to know where to start. One of the things that worries many people involved in this issue, and something which is often used by clinics to divert criticism from themselves, is the fact that the media have to take a slice of the blame, in that they constantly show very skinny models and portray their physical state as desirable and attractive. Well, who would blame people of all ages for trying to be like them? The major trouble is that clinics seem to be only too eager to give out diet or slimming pills, and seem very unconcerned about side effects, or even about keeping their patients' doctors informed about what is happening to them. Well, needless to say, this is something that doesn't endear slimming clinics to many of my colleagues.
I can imagine. But what exactly are these side effects?
To be frank, there are a number of them. They vary from those which are often present to those which are actually quite rare. Patients on these slimming drugs can experience shaking fits, depression, mouth ulcers, and something which is very like flu. Also, it's possible for them to experience hallucinations, and even a kind of facial numbness. So, as you can see, there are a lot of things that can go wrong, and you can't be surprised that many medical people are encouraging the overweight to take a more traditional route to weight loss through sensible dieting and exercise.
So if these clinics and their products are so bad, what has the government done to protect the public?
Well, a serious attempt was made to ban these clinics, but as you can imagine, and this will happen with any group of people who are about to be cut off from an important source of income, the clinics made a terrific fuss. They managed to organize petitions and a letter campaign from their customers, and even a number of members of parliament rose to their defense. So I expect they're here to stay. And what we must hope for is that we can persuade the professional bodies to put in place such heavy restrictions on the use of certain slimming drugs that only the very seriously overweight would be allowed to use them.
But isn't there some recent research that ironically has come out in favor of these drugs in certain conditions?
Yes, there is indeed a feeling that certain slimming drugs should be prescribed, even for long-term use, with the seriously overweight or obese. And this is based on the feeling that obesity is a very serious problem in many countries these days, and that long-term medication, in spite of the drawbacks, is less of a threat than the obesity itself.
Well, quite clearly, this isn't a situation that has a rapid cure. Dr. Collins, many thanks for giving us the latest on slimming pills and their problems. Now we have a special report from Malaysia. Now you will hear the interview again. Welcome to this week's Medical Express program. Tonight we have the usual wide-ranging series of medical and related topics, and we start with an interview with Dr. John Collins, someone who has been watching the situation regarding slimming pills very carefully. Dr. Collins, a lot of our viewers will not have heard of the idea of pills for slimming. Can you give us a bit of background, first of all?
Of course. Basically, we're talking about a whole range of diet pills that tempt people to lose weight the easy way. Huge numbers of backstreet clinics are making a killing on this. And while the medical profession may have no real objection to that, we're very worried that not enough is understood about the side effects of these pills, and that those who really need them, the truly overweight or obese, are simply missing out. As you might expect, the usual reasons that patients give for wanting to lose weight through using slimming pills are twofold. They want to look better for holidays or special occasions, and they also realize that they'll probably feel better as well if they shed a few kilos.
Well, all of that sounds quite predictable and understandable, but where are the grounds for concern?
It's hard to know where to start. One of the things that worries many people involved in this issue, and something which is often used by clinics to divert criticism from themselves, is the fact that the media have to take a slice of the blame, in that they constantly show very skinny models and portray their physical state as desirable and attractive. Well, who would blame people of all ages for trying to be like them? The major trouble is that clinics seem to be only too eager to give out diet or slimming pills, and seem very unconcerned about side effects, or even about keeping their patients' doctors informed about what is happening to them. Well, needless to say, this is something that doesn't endear slimming clinics to many of my colleagues.
I can imagine. But what exactly are these side effects?
To be frank, there are a number of them. They vary from those which are often present to those which are actually quite rare. Patients on these slimming drugs can experience shaking fits, depression, mouth ulcers, and something which is very like flu. Also, it's possible for them to experience hallucinations, and even a kind of facial numbness. So, as you can see, there are a lot of things that can go wrong, and you can't be surprised that many medical people are encouraging the overweight to take a more traditional route to weight loss through sensible dieting and exercise.
So if these clinics and their products are so bad, what has the government done to protect the public?
Well, a serious attempt was made to ban these clinics, but as you can imagine, and this will happen with any group of people who are about to be cut off from an important source of income, the clinics made a terrific fuss. They managed to organize petitions and a letter campaign from their customers, and even a number of members of parliament rose to their defense. So I expect they're here to stay. And what we must hope for is that we can persuade the professional bodies to put in place such heavy restrictions on the use of certain slimming drugs that only the very seriously overweight would be allowed to use them.
But isn't there some recent research that ironically has come out in favour of these drugs in certain conditions?
Yes, there is indeed a feeling that certain slimming drugs should be prescribed, even for long-term use, with the seriously overweight or obese. And this is based on the feeling that obesity is a very serious problem in many countries these days, and that long-term medication, in spite of the drawbacks, is less of a threat than the obesity itself.
Well, quite clearly, this isn't a situation that has a rapid cure. Dr. Collins, many thanks for giving us the latest on slimming pills and their problems. Now we have a special report from Malaysia.
That is the end of part two. In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one.
Part 3. Exercise 1. Questions 13 to 18. Listen to this spokesperson for the Scientific Exploration Society and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the talk twice.
So, thank you, Mohammed Anwar, for that fascinating insight into the tigers of Bengal. We stay in the Indian subcontinent with the latest activities of the Scientific Exploration Society. Sue Muller has the information.
The Scientific Exploration Society continues to do exciting work with animals all over the world. Many people may be surprised, however, to learn that someone like me, a police fingerprint expert, has just been recruited by one of the Society's teams to help track down the world's largest Asian elephant. The elephants in question, some are as tall as 13 feet, were discovered in western Nepal some 4 years ago, and were believed at that time to be descended from the ancient hairy elephant known as the mammoth. They were quite confident about this, because these creatures had the distinctive twin domes which featured in ancient cave drawings of mammoths. However, after a series of rigorous tests, it became very clear that these elephants were not mammoths, but distant cousins of the Indian elephant. This may have been disappointing, but the fact that about 30 more of these elephants had moved into a Nepalese national park created a real stir of interest among zoologists and conservationists, now very eager to learn more about these elusive creatures. The experts believe that every elephant leaves a quite distinctive footprint, each with its own unique pattern, and that's why they've got me involved in this, as the expert who will photograph these giant footprints and try to identify individual animals and their movements in the hope of safeguarding their future survival. The idea of using footprint technology came from other colleagues from the Exploration Society who successfully tracked rhinos in Zimbabwe. We're using a computer program developed by other members of our team. In the past, zoologists and scientists tried to identify elephants by the shape of their ears or the size of their tusks, and the idea of electronically tagging these huge animals was rejected on the grounds that it was simply too expensive. These days, however, fingerprinting is reckoned to be best for both man and animal, although it is certainly no simple task. The trouble is that elephants walk by putting their back feet into the print made by their front feet, and the result is often far from clear. At the same time, taking a cast of their footprints is also extremely difficult, because they're usually found in very fine dust. The expedition team, which we've put together, includes 16 members of the public, who have each paid a great deal of money for the privilege of living and camping in the national park, a privilege which is denied to the relatively small number of backpackers and tourists who visit this remote part of Nepal each year. This will be my third trip there, and fortunately, I've always been lucky enough to get sponsorship from somebody. And my fascination with elephants goes all the way back to my childhood, when my mother took me to see them at the local zoo. Other kids had teddy bears, I had little elephants. The trouble with elephants in Nepal is that although there aren't many of them, they're in constant conflict with local people. Often they are attacked by villagers or killed by government marksmen. Because of all this, what we'd really like to do is to create a safe corridor for elephants to travel through the countryside.
Thank you, Sue. Well, if anyone out there is interested, the next trip to study elephants in Nepal is planned for February 1998. Why not get in touch with the society? You'll get the telephone number at the end of the program.
Now you will hear the talk again.
So, thank you, Mohammed Anwar, for that fascinating insight into the tigers of Bengal. We stay in the Indian subcontinent with the latest activities of the Scientific Exploration Society. Sue Muller has the information.
The Scientific Exploration Society continues to do exciting work with animals all over the world. Many people may be surprised, however, to learn that someone like me, a police fingerprint expert, has just been recruited by one of the Society's teams to help track down the world's largest Asian elephant. The elephants in question, some are as tall as 13 feet, were discovered in western Nepal some 4 years ago, and were believed at that time to be descended from the ancient hairy elephant known as the mammoth. They were quite confident about this, because these creatures had the distinctive twin domes which featured in ancient cave drawings of mammoths. However, after a series of rigorous tests, it became very clear that these elephants were not mammoths, but distant cousins of the Indian elephant. This may have been disappointing, but the fact that about 30 more of these elephants had moved into a Nepalese national park created a real stir of interest among zoologists and conservationists, now very eager to learn more about these elusive creatures. The experts believe that every elephant leaves a quite distinctive footprint, each with its own unique pattern, and that's why they've got me involved in this, as the expert who will photograph these giant footprints and try to identify individual animals and their movements in the hope of safeguarding their future survival. The idea of using footprint technology came from other colleagues from the Exploration Society who successfully tracked rhinos in Zimbabwe. We're using a computer program developed by other members of our team. In the past, zoologists and scientists tried to identify elephants by the shape of their ears or the size of their tusks. And the idea of electronically tagging these huge animals was rejected on the grounds that it was simply too expensive. These days, however, fingerprinting is reckoned to be best for both man and animal, although it is certainly no simple task. The trouble is that elephants walk by putting their back feet into the print made by their front feet, and the result is often far from clear. At the same time, taking a cast of their footprints is also extremely difficult, because they're usually found in very fine dust. The expedition team, which we've put together, includes 16 members of the public, who have each paid a great deal of money for the privilege of living and camping in the national park, a privilege which is denied to the relatively small number of backpackers and tourists who visit this remote part of Nepal each year. This will be my third trip there. Unfortunately, I've always been lucky enough to get sponsorship from somebody. And my fascination with elephants goes all the way back to my childhood, when my mother took me to see them at the local zoo. Other kids had teddy bears. I had little elephants. The trouble with elephants in Nepal is that although there aren't many of them, they're in constant conflict with local people. Often they are attacked by villagers or killed by government marksmen. Because of all this, what we'd really like to do is to create a safe corridor for elephants to travel through the countryside.
Thank you, Sue. Well, if anyone out there is interested, the next trip to study elephants in Nepal is planned for February 1998. Why not get in touch with the Society? You'll get the telephone number at the end of the program. That is the end of Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2.
Part 3. Exercise 2. Questions 19 to 23. Listen to this broadcast about recent fires in Dusseldorf and Bangkok, and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the broadcast twice.
The recent deadly hotel blaze in Bangkok is just the latest in a series of disasters involving public buildings that demonstrates the unpredictability of fire hazards. So can anything be done to prevent yet another tragedy? I put this question to Jan Smith, a lucky survivor of the terrible fire last April in Dusseldorf Airport. Jan survived a fire which killed 16 people and injured 60 others.
To be honest with you, I thought I'd had it, and was quite convinced that I was about to die. And this might surprise you, I wasn't really scared, I was just very, very angry. I'd gone to the toilet, and was about to return to the lounge to finish my drink, when another traveller burst into the toilet and told me to stay where I was. At the time, I thought he was some sort of idiot, and completely ignored him. But as soon as I opened the door, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. When I'd left the lounge, I'd travelled down a perfectly normal airport corridor. But now, there was this thick black wall of toxic smoke. I couldn't see anybody or anything, and had the feeling that if I stuck my hand into the smoke, I'd never see it again. What I still don't understand about the horrors of the fire at Dusseldorf Airport is that, in spite of the people I talked to about this, and who were involved in the fire, I haven't to this day met anybody who saw any flames at all.
There are lots of parallels between the fire at Dusseldorf and the most recent horrific blaze at the President Tower Hotel in Bangkok. At least two people are reckoned to have died, and hundreds of others were injured. There's no real evidence yet, of course, but a faulty air conditioning system may well have been the guilty party. Jan Smith talking again about the fire at Dusseldorf.
Well, as far as I understand it, the trouble at the airport stemmed from the fact that ventilation fans didn't shut down as they should have, and all that circulating air simply helped to spread the smoke and fumes more rapidly through the terminal building.
And it seems that a problem with the brand new ventilation system in the Bangkok incident may well have started the fire, or an explosion which led to the fire. Here's Al Moreau, a British fire safety expert.
Anyone who knows anything about these fires can see that the terrible events of Bangkok and Dusseldorf merely highlight the unpredictability of this deadly hazard. It's true that in the UK more than 90% of buildings' fires are safely contained, but equally it's the case that the remaining 10% have meant that around 1,000 people a year die in fires in the UK, and that the damage to property is estimated to be in the area of £1 billion. What I can't forgive is the fact that it's very, very difficult to get money for research for fires of this sort. And this, of course, means that there is very little likelihood of any serious improvement. As buildings have been more thoroughly insulated to conserve energy, so they have become better and better at containing fires. This has meant a build-up of heat and gases, and as soon as somebody innocently opens a door, there can be a huge and fatal explosion.
So, what can be done? Al Moreau again.
We've got to improve both the active and the passive measures for fire prevention. If we're talking about passive measures, we mean more and more fireproof materials in walls and floors, or hoods that prevent smoke from spreading. As far as active measures are concerned, we need to make certain we have things like more sprinkler systems, or other methods of cooling or smothering a fire.
Well, one thing that I've learned that both our speakers have in common is that they never go to bed in a strange hotel without checking the fire escape route. This must be a good piece of advice for all of you listening out there.
Now you will hear the broadcast again. The recent deadly hotel blaze in Bangkok is just the latest in a series of disasters involving public buildings that demonstrates the unpredictability of fire hazards. So can anything be done to prevent yet another tragedy? I put this question to Jan Smith, a lucky survivor of the terrible fire last April in Dusseldorf Airport. Jan survived a fire which killed 16 people and injured 60 others.
To be honest with you, I thought I'd had it, and was quite convinced that I was about to die. And this might surprise you, I wasn't really scared, I was just very, very angry. I'd gone to the toilet, and was about to return to the lounge to finish my drink, when another traveller burst into the toilet and told me to stay where I was. At the time, I thought he was some sort of idiot, and completely ignored him. But as soon as I opened the door, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. When I'd left the lounge, I'd travelled down a perfectly normal airport corridor. But now, there was this thick black wall of toxic smoke. I couldn't see anybody or anything, and had the feeling that if I stuck my hand into the smoke, I'd never see it again. What I still don't understand about the horrors of the fire at Dusseldorf Airport is that, in spite of the people I talked to about this, and who were involved in the fire, I haven't to this day met anybody who saw any flames at all.
There are lots of parallels between the fire at Dusseldorf and the most recent horrific blaze at the President Tower Hotel in Bangkok. At least two people are reckoned to have died, and hundreds of others were injured. There's no real evidence yet, of course, but a faulty air conditioning system may well have been the guilty party. Jan Smith talking again about the fire at Dusseldorf.
Well, as far as I understand it, the trouble at the airport stemmed from the fact that ventilation fans didn't shut down as they should have, and all that circulating air simply helped to spread the smoke and fumes more rapidly through the terminal building.
And it seems that a problem with the brand new ventilation system in the Bangkok incident may well have started the fire, or an explosion which led to the fire. Here's Al Moreau, a British fire safety expert.
Anyone who knows anything about these fires can see that the terrible events of Bangkok and Dusseldorf merely highlight the unpredictability of this deadly hazard. It's true that in the UK more than 90% of buildings' fires are safely contained, but equally it's the case that the remaining 10% have meant that around 1,000 people a year die in fires in the UK, and that the damage to property is estimated to be in the area of £1 billion. What I can't forgive is the fact that it's very, very difficult to get money for research for fires of this sort. And this, of course, means that there is very little likelihood of any serious improvement. As buildings have been more thoroughly insulated to conserve energy, so they have become better and better at containing fires. This has meant a build-up of heat and gases, and as soon as somebody innocently opens a door, there can be a huge and fatal explosion.
So, what can be done? Al Moreau again.
We've got to improve both the active and the passive measures for fire prevention. If we're talking about passive measures, we mean more and more fireproof materials in walls and floors, or hoods that prevent smoke from spreading. As far as active measures are concerned, we need to make certain we have things like more sprinkler systems, or other methods of cooling or smothering a fire.
Well, one thing that I've learned that both our speakers have in common is that they never go to bed in a strange hotel without checking the fire escape route. This must be a good piece of advice for all of you listening out there. That is the end of part three and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, candidate number, and center number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected.